All right, well, glad that you are here. Hopefully you've had a good day so far. Hopefully your hearts have been encouraged and challenged and blessed, and that you have that your minds have been provoked to think as well. That really has been my burden for the conference, is helping New Englanders, including myself, including our church people, but helping us think biblically about important topics. So next year we'll do the family. I really highlight that with Dr. and Mrs. Herbster next year. So that's really the point of this. So this is a workshop, Your Marriage Counts, Keys to Strong Ministry Marriages. I was talking about this with my wife this last week, and she said, well, is it just for pastors? I said, well, no, it's not. But, you know, particularly targeting us as pastors in the ministry, because our marriage is important. One of the things... You may have run into this as well, but sometimes you come across a pastor who begins to talk and share some burdens, unload a bit, talking about some struggles that they're having in the marriage. And that is heart-wrenching for me. I mean, no marriage is perfect, okay? We all know that. We're all on a level playing field. But there are certain occasions where you think they're in trouble. They're in serious trouble. Unless something happens, unless God's grace intervenes, unless they make some serious changes. It really has to do with ministerial integrity, I think. You look at the qualifications for pastoral ministry. Your family, particularly your marriage, is vital. It doesn't mean every pastor has to be married, but it does mean if that pastor is married, that is a vital, vital aspect of their ministry overall. I thought I'd introduce this by throwing out a question. Can you think of any particular names of particular individuals that have been publicized, men in pastoral type of ministry who've had to step down, they're fired, resigning, or whatever, because of some kind of marital problems, infidelity, whatever. Can you think of any names like that? Either they did, or even they should have stepped down. Sometimes they don't. Think of any names? Yeah, Dan?
Well, I mean, our own home church where we came from in New Jersey, our pastor had an affair with the partner.
Wow. Okay.
Destroyed two families and many people in the church.
Wow. That's hard.
We were just newly married at the time, so it was very hard.
Yes, I bet. Other examples?
Yeah, I think of Jack Scott. I didn't follow in the church or anything. I had friends that did, and I remember seeing pictures on their Facebook of him preaching with people at the altar, and that was the service where the girl was back in his office and was waiting for him to come back. He was going to come back and do the next thing he was going to do with her.
Wow.
Was very scarring.
Yeah.
For that.
Yeah, horrific.
Even though I wasn't a part of it, just for my friend's sake.
Yeah. What else to do? Yeah, Nick?
Our city church had an assistant pastor where his wife left, but there were major issues that came out. Mm.
So sad. Yeah, Jeff?
I think I have a couple in our time in Canada. There was a leading church up there that the pastor ended up resigning after doing that right after he committed suicide, because he could not face the fact of what he had done and the difficulties that he had brought to it. And then in our church up there, we had a young assistant and his wife. They were about a year into their marriage. They joined us on our staff, and he lasted about a year in ministry when he then came to me to tell me that he's going to have to step away because he and his wife weren't getting along. Either need to save his marriage or he was going to lose it all. And wisely counseled him. I thought that what he was doing was wise, and I was thankful that he made that decision. Mm-hmm. And the blessing to know with them is that they're back in ministry now after being out about 5 or 6 years. Mm. So I'm thankful for that, but it's difficult to watch a young man go through that.
Right, yes. I think even some of the, the highly publicized, I mean, years ago, you had someone like Jimmy Swaggart of the world, okay? that was a major publicized event. You had the perhaps a feigned repentance on TV, you know, big tears and so forth. He's still doing his thing. Jim Baker, Jim and Tammy Baker, you know those names. Another case, and yet he still has a ministry. It's a different kind. What's that?
Charles Stanley,
yeah. Or in more recent times, how do you pronounce his name? Tolian Chavijan? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's how you say his last name, but in March 2016, he was fired because of an, quote-unquote, inappropriate relationship with someone. And apparently, even before that, in a previous church, he admitted to committing adultery. And yet he still was able to find, you know, another church ministry. Or in 2018, Bill Hybels, another big name, resigned due to sexual misconduct allegations and so forth. That ministry, that's a fascinating ministry if you've never really looked at that, how it began, and now it seems perhaps how it's starting to crumble. I mean, a really, really amazing thing. And we've mentioned others that we know of in our own circles as well. Now, when you hear of things like that, examples like that, what goes through your mind?
Didn't happen overnight.
Yep. Some kind of process was happening.
Let him who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. It's always a warning to me.
Yes. Major, major cause for, oh boy. Look out, Dan.
I was going to say the same basis.
Yeah. Nick?
I know when it happened at our Sunday church assistant pastor, I was working a secular job. I took the next day off and spent it with my wife. And you know, just to make sure my marriage is, you know, I don't, we were having issues, but just
yes,
to, you know, do some preventative maintenance.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, there's a sense of, your mind may spin and say, boy, what happened? What led up to that point? What was going on for the years or however long it took place? That's a natural thing to wonder. You may never find out, but it's a natural thing to wonder. But I think that the two primary aspects are perhaps some shock, but also some warning. Oh God, I am no better than that man. You know, I heard it said in college, any one of us, given the right provocation, the right circumstance, can commit the most heinous of acts. You know, you're young, you think, oh, no, I'd never do that. It needs to be a cause of warning for us, as well as grief. We ought to grieve for those situations. I want to talk this morning, let me get this out as well. You can follow along if you, as you wish. You can fill in blanks if you want. Nothing, just not going to be earth-shattering today. These are going to be reminders for us, but you know, we're, most of us here are pastors, we're in some kind of ministry. We need these reminders too. Desperately need them as well. So I want to start off just by some biblical principles. We'll talk through some life hindrances, some practical suggestions, and then some important reminders. So first, biblical principle, we're required to have moral integrity in our marriage. 1 Timothy 3:2, Titus 1:6 both give as part of the qualifications being the husband of one wife. Okay, however you choose to define that, it basically means one woman, man. There's debate on what that means with divorce. I'm not here to talk about that. However you define that, you can't deny it means moral integrity. Fidelity to your wife. That prohibits us from playing the field. It prohibits us from flirting with others. It prohibits us from surveying the land, or just from doing stupid stuff. Sometimes I'll joke with our high school kids who are going off to college. You know, it's meant, and it garners a laugh often, but I mean it, and I tell them I mean it. I tell them, don't do anything stupid. And that's true. Man, we shouldn't do anything stupid. And that stupidity encompasses a lot of different activities, okay? And I think we know that. But moral integrity is a requirement. Your wife is God's gift to you, intellectually, spiritually, ministerially, emotionally, and physically. Be committed to her. be committed to her. Second biblical principle, we are commanded to practice marital intimacy. Ephesians 5:25 tells husbands three times to love your wife. 1 Corinthians 7 talks about do not defraud one another. Do not defraud your wife. Your body is not your own. A biblical principle of our body, it's not ours. It's first of all God's. We bought with a price. And as married men, it's our wives. Mm-hmm. That's the biblical priority there. And we're commanded to practice this marital intimacy. What does that love mean? Well, it is self-sacrificial. It is all those things that we know. But men, it does also encompass the intimacy level as well that our wives need, that we need. So we're commanded to do this. Love is self-sacrifice for the benefit of others, particularly in this context of marriage, particularly our wife. We make vows to our wives that we make to no one else. You don't make the vows to your children that you've made to your wife. You don't make the vows to your church that you make to your wife. It's a sacred commitment, an intimate one, in a variety of levels, physically included. So tell her that you love her frequently, daily, meaningfully, and show it to her as well. There's a book, and other things have been written about that as well, but the idea of sex, it doesn't just begin in the bedroom. It's a lifestyle thing. Okay, it's doing things for her, not just in the bedroom, but in the normal routine things of life. So marital intimacy. Thirdly, we are instructed to mentally appreciate our wives. 1 Peter 3, verse 7. This is the context here of mutually submissive relationships. It tells us as husbands to dwell with our wives according to knowledge. Oh, man. You do that study. We are commanded, we're required to understand, not women in general. You only have to try to understand one. And that's your wife. To mentally appreciate her, to dwell with her according to knowledge, giving honor unto her as unto the weaker vessel. That passage is challenging and convicting, because you read to the end of that verse and it tells us our relationship to our wife is directly related to our relationship with our God. If we don't dwell with her in an understanding way, if we don't honor her, if we don't give her that respect, it says, lest your prayers be hindered, or that your prayers be not hindered. Our prayer life, our spiritual relationship with God is hindered if we don't commit ourselves to what that verse teaches. Fourthly, this is a general principle. As pastors, we are to model a godly marriage before our people. I remember when we were I was candidating down here 12 plus years ago now. We were talking with my former pastor, Ken Endy, and his wife, Judy. Our kids were three at the time. You know, parents with young kids going to a new place, you're trying to, you know, make a good impression, first impression. We were all concerned, well, what if our kids, you know, do this? What if our kids do this? And we never forgotten some of the counsel that, I think Judy actually said this, Judy Endy told us this particularly. Everyone knows your children will act up. Everyone knows there's going to be issues. It's how you handle those that's important. And same with marriage. Everyone knows no marriage is perfect. Right? None of us, you ought to think you have a perfect marriage. But everyone knows no one has a perfect marriage. But how do we handle that when little things come in? We're going to handle those biblically as men, as husbands. Are we going to lead our wives in how to handle these things? Because our church is watching. I mean, your church should know that you're a guy, you're a regular family, you know, you're going to have little things here and there. But how do you handle those? That's crucial. Okay, so some biblical principles that I think are important to understand. Secondly, let's look at some life hindrances. What kind of things hinder hinder or can hinder our marriages from flourishing. Let me offer you a few, and know that you could probably think of others. Number one there, workaholism. I fear that this is one of the major things that can cause harm to the marriage of a pastor when the pastor becomes a workaholic. He's gone away from home a lot, doesn't spend a lot of time with his wife, children at home when he ought to. Maybe he's in the study for hours on end, even at home when he should be interacting more with his wife and kids. I know of a pastor and wife, not from New England, different region of the country. The wife told my wife, "Sometimes I wish my husband was the Schwann's man." You know, the Schwann's man at the ice cream truck. And because her husband tended towards workaholism. And he knew it. He knew it. But there's that's a real concern in ministry. Legitimately, all of us could probably spend twice as much time doing the work of the ministry, however you define that, than we do currently. I was looking online about this a little bit. Thomas Rainer, in 2013, did a Twitter study asking full-time pastors about the average number of hours per week they put in. This is 2013. Here are the results. 47% said between 40 and 49 hours a week. 50%, let me do this, break it down a little bit more. 40% were 50 to 59 hours a week, and 10% were 60 or more. Okay, so roughly half and half. Roughly half were fewer than 50 hours a week, and half were more than 50 hours a week. Now, we all know, weeks can vary. Okay, things come up. I was at home Tuesday night, taking out the air conditioners in my house, get a phone call or a text at shortly after 7 p.m. 99-year-old guy in our church had a significant stroke, I was told. So I go to the hospital. My kids were home. My wife was at a doggy meeting trying to train our dog. My kids were home. I said, "Guys, I got to go." They know. They understand. Thankfully, they're old enough. I can do that now. And I was at the hospital for like 4 hours with the family. Those things happen. Okay, we know that. Nothing new. But this workaholism comes into play when the exceptions become the rule. And that can cause great harm to your marriage. You're married to your wife. You shouldn't be married to your church. That's a Catholic view. We're married to our wives. And a good wife will understand the ebbs and flows of that. They'll be understanding. But we ought to seek to spend ample time with our wives, with our children, understand the ebb and flow of those things. But workaholism is a danger. Secondly, health or various illnesses. My wife and I, we really do have a fantastic marriage. But I will admit, my own personal health has been a cause of stress and discussions and things to really work through. I have ulcerative colitis. I've had it since just before my kids were born. And that has ups and downs. And in times when it was really bad, oh, I struggled personally, which meant it affected my wife and our relationship. And we've had to work through those things together. And she's been gracious and kind, honest, forthright in communicating things with me. But men, we all know health can be a great hindrance, whatever that is. There's some pastors in New England with chronic illnesses and health concerns. But those things can be. They don't have to be, but they can be hindrances to having a healthy, growing marriage. On a slightly lesser degree, not necessarily a diagnosis of sorts, but even stress is a part of that. With what I have, ulcerative colitis, stress isn't the cause, but it certainly doesn't help what I have. And stress tends to exacerbate whatever else may be going on in your life. So there's also learning how to deal with stress. My gastroenterologist early on said, "Well, is your job stressful?" Well, I'm a pastor of a church. Oh, okay. Well, and he understood that. Doesn't mean it's the cause, but it certainly doesn't help. A third hindrance is financial issues. We all know the pastorate is not a get-rich-quick scheme. And there can be financial strains even in ministry. And if you're not aligned philosophically with your wife on a financial level, there's going to be struggles. Sometimes there seems like there's more month than money. I think that's a Dave Ramseyism, I think. But financial struggles can be a real difficulty in the home. Are we budgeting properly? Are we giving properly? Are we spending and saving and all those different things? Are you being wise with your funds? If there's not agreement there, there's going to be great distress in your marriage. This is several years back now, but not a pastor in ministry, but another couple who was attending our church, 30 years of marriage, not one of them was happy. Large degree because of finances. And it can be a major hindrance. Fourth, parenting philosophy. If you still have kids at home, you and your wife need to have agreement in how you're going to raise and discipline your children. Your family is your primary discipleship opportunity. And in that whole context, your wife is first and foremost, and your kids as well. But if you and your wife are not aligned in agreement, even before you have kids, about how you're going to raise your family, what kind of standards you're going to have, what kind of principles and philosophy you're going to enact, you'll have some problems. And then five is just broad in general, but the pride, the flesh, and sin. They really summarize much of what is in the other four, but when you get married, you are two sinful people living in close proximity to one another. And your flesh, and your pride, and your sinful nature, living next to and sleeping next to someone else in that close of a relationship, there's going to be things that come up. Before we were married, we had a premarital counseling class with Dr. Jim Berg. Best thing we ever did before we got married. So helpful. And he saw us after we were married, walking on campus, and he sat in a student chat with us and asked how things were going and so forth. And he said, marriage is great. You find out how selfish you are, and it gets gooder and gooder after that. And that is so true. It brings out the selfishness, the pride, the fleshliness in us, and we just need to deal with that so it doesn't hinder us. All right, some practical suggestions. Here's some things that I think are wise, maybe thought-provoking for you. Number one, put things in place as safeguards on your devices and computers. There's all kinds of things you can do with that in order to make that happen. Just find one that works for you best. But that, I think that is important. In this day and age, when we have the world in our pockets, boy, we got to do something. We got to do something. Number two, do not be alone with another woman in private. Remember Mike Pence's testimony? How he got lambasted for that. But that's important. Number three, do things for your wife around the house.
Amen.
This is not just building things. Okay, you might really like to build things. It's not just that, although that can be there as well. But help with the dishes. Make dinner, or at least offer to help with dinner. Make sure you take out the trash. One thing I found out in marriage is I think I underestimated how important to my wife the little things taken care of around the house or with the car is important to her. She values those things. And it's the little things that I do that mean a lot or that can really help build and grow your marriage. A simple thing. That's important. And you don't do it thinking, okay, if I do this, then maybe tonight, you know, don't think that. You do it because you love her. Self-sacrifice for the benefit of your wife. Number four, going along with that a little bit, buy flowers for her just because. We don't need a show of hands, but when was the last time you just bought your wife flowers? No reason. Hey, that'd be something good to do. No, you're not going to go home tonight and buy flowers for your wife. I don't know. But buy flowers for just, again, that's a simple thing. It doesn't have to cost a lot. Trader Joe's. We have a Trader Joe's nearby. They have beautiful bouquets of flowers for really not a lot of money at all. And they last a long time. They're great. Little thing. Invest, little investment to the health and strength of your marriage. Number five, plan date nights. Plan date nights. Say, how often? Most likely more often than we're doing it right now. Okay, most likely. Most likely. But plan some date nights. Number six, go to bed when your wife goes to bed. This is something I do. I didn't last night. That's really the one exception. Mike and Mark didn't get to my house till a little after midnight. And my wife willingly and voluntarily went to bed before they got there. Okay, but generally speaking, I go to bed when Crystal goes to bed. Just to safeguard, so that, you know, we're not up wicked late watching something or on the computer, all that kind of stuff. A lot of bad things happen in the dark. Number seven, discuss things that matter to her. Some of the sweetest times we have as a couple is just talking about things that are on her mind. We can talk about ministry until we're blue in the face with our wives. But ask her what's on her mind, what's on her heart, what's the concerns that she's dealing with the kids, or with if she has a job or a business of some kind. You know, my wife has an online card business. So we talk about things about that, or the kids' education, you know, whatever. Number eight, involve her in ministry when possible. I love serving with my family. And involve her when possible. Number nine, show public affection for her at church. Caveat, of course. Okay. But wouldn't it be a nice thing if your church family actually saw that you loved your wife? Holding her hand, putting your arm around her. Even a little smooch here and there is fine. But showing that public affection. Number 10, do not make fun of her or make her the brunt of your jokes. I'm not going to park there a lot, but I don't believe that is honoring to our wives when we make her the brunt of the joke. Number 11, read books about marriage together. And there's some suggestions on the bottom there. But maybe you haven't done that or haven't done it in a while. Be a good opportunity to discuss things. And then number 12, go to couples retreats or create your own getaway weekend. We've done this several times. I'll share a funny story. Jeff up at Cornerstone, they've done couples retreats a few times up in the Mount Washington area. We registered for, I believe it was the first one. And that weekend came, and I believe it was my son who got ill, like throwing up ill, and he was several years younger than he is now. So my wife couldn't go. And I was in a dilemma. Do I go? I went. I thought, I paid for the hotel night. And I knew people, I knew I would, you know, enjoy the time and the sessions and so forth. So I went. It was odd. I think I was the only, I don't know if you remember that, Jeff, but I was the only single guy, I think, up there. So after the dinner, after the last session, I think Dr. and Mrs. Herbst were there at that one too. Everybody's, you know, all right, you have time to go, you know, outside and enjoy a romantic walk on, you know, this and that. And I'm thinking to myself, I can't do that. So that was kind of a joke. But are you doing something to get away? It was not an official retreat like that. Those are helpful. Maybe just pull your wife away for an overnight or a weekend or something like that. We've done that a few times. We go up to a place up at Kennebunkport we love. A little getaway. Nothing fancy, nothing outlandish, but it sure is nice just to pull away. That's a good making investment into your marriage. Fourth, important reminders. If your marriage suffers, your credibility to help marriages in your church suffers. Doesn't mean you can't say anything, but there'd be at least a marring of that. Number two, if your marriage suffers, you'll be more prone to look elsewhere for affirmation, attention, and affection. That's true. That's not just for pastors. That's marriage and life. If your marriage is suffering as a man, you're going to look for that attention that you want, that affection that you want, from somewhere, someone else. Number three, if your marriage suffers, you're giving your children a bad example to follow. Think of it this way. Your kids look to you as an example of marriage. What kind of example are we giving them? Both my wife and I come from divorced homes. But in my life growing up, it was another godly family, godly marriage that I could look to and say, that's what I want to be like. That man exemplified to me Christ and how he treated his wife, how he raised his kids, ministered in the church, faithful, godly man. I want to be that kind of couple for my kids. They know we're not perfect, but I want to model before them so that they can raise their kids, my grandkids, in a way that's going to honor the Lord as well. Number four, if your marriage suffers, you need to seek help. So I'm a pastor. Who would I go to for help? Yeah, that's a tough one. Go to another pastor, friend that you can confide in, maybe someone from a different state or an older pastor that you know of, but you got to seek some kind of help. And then number five, if your marriage suffers, it's most likely... it's most likely your fault. I remember in college, I read a book, and the author made basically that statement, if after 5 years there's problems in your marriage, it's your fault. As a husband, I thought to myself, what? How can that be? And if you've married any length of time, you know, oh, that's why. So just take the onus. Take the ownership of whatever problems are there. Not to say there isn't fault elsewhere, but take the ownership. You didn't lead properly then. And you got to be the man that God wants you to be and take the initiative in that and see what you can do. As pastors and men in gospel ministry, we cannot ignore our marriages for the sake of the ministry. Our marriage is our main ministry. A pastor friend of mine from California posted on Facebook a few days ago, he said this statement, God will never give you a ministry that costs your marriage and family. It's easier for God to replace you in the church than for God to replace you at home. Your marriage is your first ministry. I thought that was good. I don't even know who said it. He was quoting someone else, but that was a good statement. I put down at the bottom some recommended resources. I have them here if you want to look at them at all. But we have a few minutes left. Anything else that you want to add to that, whether a practical suggestion or anything at all, you say, boy, my wife and I, we've really found out that this is helpful for our marriage. Here are these books, Sweethearts for a Lifetime, one of the best marriage books I've read, Wayne and Carol Mack. 8 Rules for Communication for Successful Marriages, Dr. Steve Scheidner. If you've seen the YouTube movie In My Seat, anybody seen that? 9/11 story, that's this guy, he and his wife. Love and Respect by Dr. Emerson Eggerichs, that's a good book. Particularly for husbands, I know of really no better book on being a husband than The Complete Husband by Lou Priolo. Spanker of a book, in a good way. And then A Remarkable Marriage by Dr. David Whitcomb, down in South Carolina. Tremendous book there as well. All right, the floor is open. We have a few minutes left. Anything you want to recommend as well that's really worked well for you guys?
Ministry of Marriage, Jim Binney.
Yes, Ministry of Marriage by Jim Binney. Another good book there. Anything else, guys? What's worked for you? What kind of investments have you made? You say, you know, we've really tried to make this happen in our lives, in our marriage, and we've really found it to be really helpful. Yeah, Steve?
A friend of mine, Ken Collier, from the Wilds, he told me many times that I can do anything at the office if everything's right at home. And there's so much truth to that. If I'm not right with my wife, we're not on the same page, mm-hmm. I have a real hard time going to the office, so to speak. And so it's worth it sometimes just to go home and make sure things are right there before you try to go help other people.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah, man.
What are some, I'm asking you guys, what's some things that, how did you make or find time for prayer with your wife, reading a book, I don't know, discussing a book, discussing passages, and then now kids, then having family devotions. What were some, I don't know, anything that just like made it happen? Because that's one of the hardest things, you know. Just as simple as just make sure I have time, prayer time with my wife.
For us, how we started before we had kids, we were married for 5-ish years before we had kids. For us, it was having simple prayer together. We did that every night. We made a... before we went to bed. Just before we went to bed. We had a like a 3x5 card box, and we divided each day for different subject matter to pray for. And we still really follow that format today. Monday night is missionaries. Tuesday night, family. Wednesday night is church-related needs, like from prayer meeting. Thursday night is friends. Friday night is leadership, government. We also pray for Christian college leaders. Saturday night, we're praying for Sunday, particularly for pastors in our own church ministry. And then Sunday night, we're praying for ourselves, our own family needs. We started that as a married couple before the kids. As the kids were born and grew up, we still did that just as a couple. As our kids got old enough to read Bible stories too, we started incorporating that. And now our kids are almost 16.
When
do we do that? That's changed.
Okay.
You have to figure out when is going to work for you.
Okay.
Some families do it like after breakfast. We did it historically for the longest time just before our kids went to bed, about 9 o'clock. Now my kids are working jobs and I've really had to think, okay, this isn't working like I wanted to. So we've kind of shifted to just after dinner. We're all sitting around the table, most nights anyway. So we've really tried to do it then.
We had a rule, especially when the kids were younger, no Bible, no breakfast. So, you know, we did our family devotion early.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Other thoughts on that?
It was easy for us, you know, working at home, kids being homeschooled, it was easier.
Mm-hmm.
But, I know pastors would have to be bivocational or
right.
Whatnot, then,
you
know, there's a whole other job.
Yeah.
That's what worked for us.
One thing, when people ask me about family devotion, family worship, whatever they call it, one of the things that I find a lot of guys doing is they're trying to do too much. There's a guy in my church several years back now. He had, at the time, 4, I think it was, kids or 5 kids, all elementary age and younger. And he was trying to go through the book of Hebrews with them, like 30 to 40 minutes. I said, my friend, let me highly encourage you. You can't do that. For your kids, 5 to 10 minutes, you need to stop. And you don't need to go through, you know, hermeneutical study of Hebrews for them. That was kind of a new thought for him. He was a Bible student. Loved it, which I'm thankful for. But he was trying to force that onto his kids, and he was finding it was being met with resistance. Well, I listened to a podcast of a panel discussion with godly men, older and newlyweds, about family worship. Wonderful church. You'd all know the church name probably. And that question came up. How much time do you spend? How often during the week do you do it? And really, to a man, they all said the same thing. It's maybe 10 to 15 minutes a day. And probably 3 to 4, maybe 5 days a week, depending. For us, it's like 3 or 4. Sunday night family devotion looks a little bit differently. We share blessings, testimonies for the day, something that we learned or studied in the scripture, or, you know, different things about the Lord's Day. Wednesday night, we don't really do much because we're going to church Wednesday nights. And there's usually probably 1, maybe 2 nights, other nights of the week that life just happens. But, good. I have 2:35, and that means we're done. Nothing earth-shattering here, guys. But I want to encourage you, invest wisely into your marriages. All right? Thank you.